Welcome to the Parish the Thought Show. The opinions of Brian, your host, and his guests have not been sanitized or scientifically tested, so please consume at your own risk. Now, here's Brian.
All right, Troy, welcome
to the show.
Perfect.
Thanks for coming on to talk about the sexy side of mortgages and why that matters to people.
Oh, mortgages are boring.
They are kind of boring, but you know what? I've met some people who can explain it in a sexy way that it's kind of interesting. And I know it's, you know, it, I don't know where I'm going with that, but anyway.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, obviously most people need a mortgage in order to get a house. And, you know, we're seeing a real huge uptick in first-time homebuyers. We had more first-time homebuyers in 2023 than we had since 2009. So definitely a lot of first-time homebuyers purchasing homes. A lot of that's been, you know, because there's a lot of grants available now and a lot of, you know, programs available where you can get in for, you know, 3% down or 0% down. And so we've seen a lot more first-time homebuyers than we had in the past. When I started in this business in 1992, most people actually would put 20% down. So that was the trend back in 92. You'd put a big chunk of money down. Of course, home prices were a lot cheaper back then. But
was it a trend because it was the law or did people just wanted to do that?
It was the fallacy that you had to put 20% down. Mortgage insurance was available, but most people did not want to pay mortgage insurance. And since they didn't want to pay mortgage insurance, they saved up and they bought houses a lot later in life. You know, we're seeing, I had closing this year, one girl was 21 years old and one guy was 20 years old. Both bought homes separately as young buyers because they can get into a home with, you know, a little down, you know, 3% down. That can be a gift from their parents or that can be a grant from, you know, different grant programs that are, or assistance that are available. So we're seeing a lot of younger buyers buying homes than we did in the past. I would say the younger generation is buying homes, which I think in the past there were, you know, at least 27, 28 when they're buying homes, not 20, 21 years old buying homes. So that's, I think the trend is definitely different in 2024 and 2023 than it had been in previous years. We're seeing, you know, a lot of people buying condos. You're seeing more and more condos being built, more townhouses being built. Years ago, you didn't see as many condo projects as there are today built. There's tons of townhouses. In fact, all my kids, except for a couple of them, live in townhouses. So that's, you know, obviously where the younger generation is starting out. And they'll sell those houses and they'll buy, you know, a home or a single family residence. I had a daughter, for example, that bought her first house in St. George, and she built it. And 7 months later, she turned around and sold it for $100,000 more than she paid for it. Was able for her to go and buy a house up in, you know, up here. She moved out of St. George and came up north and was able to buy a house because she acquired $100,000 that she wouldn't have able to acquire in 7 months any other way. So a great way to gain wealth is through real estate. You can try to pick the stock market. You can try to pick those Teslas or the Google or the Amazon. But there's a lot of guys that are a lot smarter than me and you that can pick stocks. But the easy way to gain wealth is buy real estate and continue to buy real estate. My dad, he's almost 90 years old. And on his 89th birthday, I asked him, well, Dad, what kind of advice can you give me? And he says, never sell real estate. He says, that's the best advice I can give you. And so, you know, I've acquired a few rental properties in my lifetime, and real estate's been good to me. It always has been good to me. I've made some poor real estate investments that didn't maybe pan out as well as I would like them to, but overall, I've never lost money in real estate. Some turn out better than other, but I think real estate's a great investment, whether you're 20 years old or you're, you know, 70 years old. It's still a great way to gain wealth and have retirement and also be able to pass on those properties to your kids. I think generational wealth is gained through real estate.
So how do people do it now? Because the market is such a, I don't know, if, have we been in a comparable market before? that's comparable to now?
I think home prices are pretty expensive than they have been in the past. But, you know, we were able to, a lot of people were able to buy in 2019, 2020, because interest rates are so low. When you're, you know, when you have 20 or 2% rate or 3% interest rate, they're able to purchase those prices. Home prices continue to go up, and the reason they continue to go up because there's still quite a demand. There's a big demand for real estate. There's a lot of people living in their mom's basements, and they want to get out. They want to buy their place of their own. So there's still quite a huge demand for real estate. We don't have the building that was taking place in 2007 or 2006 where the builders overbuilt, and there was excess supply of homes. There was too many homes on the market in 2007. And that was, you know, part of the crash, but a lot of it was because of the mortgage lending became too lax. There wasn't the guidelines or the rules or regulations instilled. And so we did see those home prices come down in 2010. But there was a glut of homes on the market. Banks had taken over so many. They had foreclosed on them, and they were selling them for, you know, for much less than they had acquired them for. So that was a very unique time in the real estate market and the mortgage market. I don't ever see that repeating. There's quite a bit of regulation now by the federal government, state government, to regulate mortgage companies, to regulate the banks, and so we don't see those loosey-goosey guidelines or regulations, you know. And so we're also seeing builders being more conservative. Builders aren't building, 500 units in one subdivision. We don't see builders building quite as many units. They're being more conservative. They don't want to set on 15 spec homes. They might build one or two model homes or two or three spec homes, but you don't see them building, you know, 20 or 30 spec homes. That just is a thing of the past. Most of the builders are building homes that they have buyers for. They're under contract. The buyers have earnest money. They have skin in the game. So you're seeing that where builders are not building excess inventory. We don't see a lot of excess inventory sitting down. One way the builders have helped is they've given a lot of seller concessions, meaning they've paid for closing costs. They've paid for 2-1 buy-downs or permanent buy-downs on their interest rate. That has helped a lot of people get into homes. We're seeing, you know, $10,000 as a norm for seller concessions right now from builders. With $10,000, you can buy the rate down. You can close a loan, even though rates might be in the sixes, but you might be able to close a loan in the fives because you've got seller concessions to help buy that interest rate down and make that a payment a little more affordable.
Tell me how it works, because I know that I used to work for a builder, and they did the 2-1 buy downs, and a lot of the times the lender would say, "Yeah, builder, let's raise your price 15 grand, and then we're going to give the buyer a $15,000 buy down." Mm-hmm. So in my mind, I'm like, "Well, it's the same numbers, but it somehow works out better for the buyer."
Yes, because
how does that work?
Because on a purchase price, rather that purchase price be $550 or $650. $10,000-$15,000 raise in purchase price isn't going to make very much difference to that payment, that monthly payment. But a 1% rate reduction makes a significant dent in that payment. So you're getting a lot more bang for your buck, to say. If you know, to buy the interest rate down gives you a lot more buying power. Something I preach all the time is get rid of that $700 truck payment, because a $700 truck payment is preventing you from buying an extra $100,000 worth of house. So now you can only qualify for $450, but you get rid of the $700 truck payment, now you can qualify for a $550 house. So there's a lot more, because it's amortized over a 30-year period, that truck payment's only amortized over maybe 4 or 5 years. So you're gonna get more bang for your buck on getting rid of the truck payment for $700. If you buy the interest rate down, you're gonna get a lot better buying power, or more buying power, by a lower interest rate than a $10,000 or $15,000 reduction in sales price. And by the builders keeping the sales price the same, let's say they're selling houses at $550, and all of a sudden if they reduced the sales price down to $540, they did a $10,000 reduction, well, all the neighbors are gonna complain, well, gosh, the builder just reduced all the sales price by 10 grand, but if they keep them all at the same $550 sales price and give $10,000 incentives, it keeps the neighbors happy also, because they're saying, oh, the home prices are still being sold at $550.
So it looks like things, if the builder does that, it sort of looks like they're throwing things on sale.
Yes.
So new people and old, with existing people, like, where's, how come I didn't get that deal?
Yeah. So it's better to give a seller concession or a builder to help buy down the rate or help pay for closing costs, because it keeps everybody happy. It's a win-win all the way around. Talk about where the market's going.
Yes. Okay. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. That was my question. What about those that are saying, oh, I'm waiting for the market to crash? And why do people think it's going to crash? Is it because, I have my theory that it seems like every 10 years there's something that happens significant in the, you know, and last was 2008 was the big crazy time.
Yeah.
So is that why people think that? That, oh, it's going to crash, people, or it's going to drop, or it's going to dip, or...
Yeah, a lot of people, one, are hopeful that the interest rates will come down. They're hopeful that home prices will come down. But that's a hope. That's more of a dream. The reality is home prices, in order to come down, there'd have to be a significant shift. There would have to be something that would cause them to come down. In Utah particularly, there's not a lot of land to build on. Unlike Texas, where there's a lot of land in Texas, so you're going to see home prices a lot less in Texas for the exact same model. You know, you can have Toll Brothers build a house in Utah and build the exact same model in Texas, and it's going to be cheaper because land is cheaper in Texas. Utah has very expensive land. Same with California. Some states have higher land prices. And so even though maybe the lumber or the labor may be similar, the land prices being so much cheaper in some states, you know, we'll see that home prices are cheaper in some states versus others. Obviously, the home prices are always higher in sunny states, whether that be Florida, Texas, Nevada, Arizona, California. Home prices are always a little bit higher in sunny states than if you're in Minnesota or if you're in North Dakota. In Michigan, home prices in colder states are a little bit cheaper because of just the environment. People want, especially to be able, if you can work from home, you're going to move to a sunnier state. You're not going to stay in a cold state where the winters are terrible and long. And if you have the ability to move to a sunny state and be paid the same or better, then you're going to make that opportunity. People are, it's easier for people to move today, especially since after COVID, because they have the ability to work from home. We have a lot of people that are in high tech that are able to work from home. My whole neighborhood is full of people that work for Adobe or GoPro or other software companies that they, you know, used to have to go to the office, and now they don't. And they have to, you know, they can do Zoom meetings once a week with their bosses, but generally they can work from home and not have to pay for the high real estate cost of San Francisco Bay Area. So the ability to work from home has changed a lot since COVID. I used to be one that would go to the office every single day. For 30 years, I went to the office every single day. I drove my car and I went to the office, and I would get there at 7 in the morning and I would leave sometimes at 7 at night. That was just the nature. Now that I have the ability to work from home, there are some days I drive to the office and I maybe only work for a few hours, or I may work for a full day, but I know that I can pick up a lot of my work at home. I have a home office where I'm able to work from home. You know, 10 years ago, that was never possible. And it is possible now to be able to work from home and to be able to give a higher level of service sometimes, because sometimes you will be able to take a call at 7 o'clock at night and you have a computer that you can get all the exact same answers that you would have had to wait and say, well, I'll have to look at that kind of stuff when I get back to the office tomorrow morning. But now you can look at it now.
Good and bad.
Good and
because,
bad, yeah.
Because you never disconnect, or you can't. Yeah.
My wife complains all the time that I'm always on the phone. And that's kind of funny, too, because when growing up, I remember my kids, you know, going to elementary school, and they said, well, what did your dad do for a living? Oh, he talks on the phone.
It's amazing what they see and what the... Yeah. He talks on the phone.
I had no idea that I was in the mortgage business. They thought that dad talked on the phone. That's what he did for a living.
That's what he does. He talks on the phone. There's a lot of talking involved.
Yeah. You're always explaining to first-time homebuyers, even second-time homebuyers, you're always explaining various terms. There's lots of terms in the mortgage business, and there's lots of acronyms. LTV, you know, loan-to-value, DTI, debt-to-income ratio. There's lots of acronyms. There's, you know, mortgage insurance, MI, PMI. There's all these acronyms, and people don't understand what a lot of those are, because they do it once and then they may go 3 or 4 years before they do a mortgage again, and then they get, oh yeah, okay, that's what that means. Oh yeah, I forgot that's what that means. And so there's a lot of training of how the process works in a mortgage, you know, gathering up all the loan documents and going through the process and of the underwriting and the closing and the funding. And there's this process that it's not the same thing as buying a car or going on to Amazon and buying something. There's quite a more process in the mortgage business for, you know, making sure that you go through all your inspections and your appraisal and your title work. And there's more of a process involved, and people need to be guided through that. You know, sometimes I'm like the GPS. I'm guiding people through the process of this and making sure that they get to the end result in a you know, easy way and not the hard way.
So let's talk to a first-time home buyer. Like, what are some steps or things that they can do to get themselves ready, whatever age there are, to purchase a home, other than, hey, double your income?
I think the top three things is, one, get your down payment ready. Get that put together. Don't wait until you found a house and then start asking grandma and dad for help on the down payment. Talk to grandma, talk to dad, say, hey, can you contribute $5,000? Can you contribute $10,000 to the purchase of a new home? Maybe go out and apply for some grants, or you know, save your money, or look at maybe borrowing against your 401k. Figure out the down payment. A lot of times I feel like a lot of people are figuring out the down payment on the 11th hour, and they're asking grandma and dad, and they're trying to get a loan from their 401k, or they're trying to scrounge up money for the down payment on the 11th hour, or they're transferring it from their stock account, from the savings account, to the money market account, and they're transferring it from 15 different banks, and it makes it really difficult to try to paper trail all that. So get your down payment all in one place and know what that is, what that's going to look like. Okay, how much can I really come up with? You know, oftentimes people, I'll ask them, how much are you going to come in to the table? What do you want to come into the table? I don't know, $17,000, $25,000, I don't know. Well, now that, narrow that down. What can you really feel comfortable with and say, okay, $25,000, that's my max. That's the max that I can spend to get into this home. Okay, now that we know that's your max, let's work backwards on that. I would say the second thing is credit. Pay off the little debts. You know, if you have an RC Wheelie account with $500 on it, you have a Home Depot card with $200 on it, a JCPenney card with $300, get those little ones paid off. Yes, everybody's still going to have their truck payment, or they're going to have some of their student loans, and they're going to have their Visa card, but get rid of all the little stuff. Get all that little stuff paid off. Third, make sure that you've got a good job history. You have to have a 2-year job history. Make sure you've got that mapped out, that if there's large gaps between employment, that could cause problems in underwriting. So make sure you have your 2-year job history mapped out. Whether that be 2 jobs, 3 jobs, or 4 jobs, make sure that you know the start and stop dates, and be consistent. Make sure you work your 40 hours. Don't take on vacations during the process or before the process, and have, you know, make sure you've got those 40-hour pay stubs. And because underwriters love to see 40-hour pay stubs. They don't want to see a 30-hour pay stub and a 15-hour pay stub and a 20-hour pay stub. Make sure it's consistent at 40 hours before you get
rid of it. Why are they so hyper-focused on the number of hours versus the volume of money someone's making? Because
they don't like variable income. Variable income is the scary thing to an underwriter. An underwriter feels like they don't know what they make. Are they going to make $5,000 this month, $3,000 a month? They don't like even commissions, bonuses. They want to see consistency. They'd much rather see somebody that's consistent rather than have a big $20,000 a month and then a $5,000 a month. To them, that's scary. They want to see consistency. Variable income is the death.
Are they a lot older underwriters usually that are, or is that just a thing now?
It's
a math thing.
That's a guideline that's straight from the federal government. So whether that be an FHA guideline or a Fannie Mae or a Freddie Mac or VA or USDA guidelines, they want to see consistency. They don't want to count overtime. They don't want to count commissions or bonuses unless there's a real consistency of seeing that over a 2-year period. So what they have found is when they've looked back and see, okay, where's your number one thing in foreclosures? Usually number one, first of all, in foreclosures is going to be non-owner occupied. Somebody that was an investment property and they couldn't make it work because they couldn't get the renters in there, or the renters left, or the furnace broke, and then the water heater broke, and then the place, well, you know, got trashed. They walk away from the house. So that's number one foreclosure, is a non-owner occupied. Number two is people that didn't have consistent income. They were counting the overtime, and then the overtime got cut, or they were counting bonuses, and they were counting commissions, and commissions got cut because the economy got trashed or whatever. So they want to see consistency in income. So when you see foreclosures, they want to see that, hey, all of a sudden this guy can't make the house payment because he was planning on this bonus that he didn't get, or he's planning on these commissions and these commissions fail. They were getting tons of overtime and now they're not getting overtime. Then you start seeing foreclosures or house payments being missed, and notice of defaults and things, problems in underwriting. And they go back to these files, and because they've got these history of all these files. Okay, what went wrong? Why did this one go back to the bank? Why did this go to foreclosure? Why are these payments being missed? And that's what they're finding, is expectations of income were not there.
All right, now let's talk to someone who's like moving up in house. Are the suggestions the same, or is it a totally different?
It's a little bit easier if you're moving up. You're moving up because, one, when you're selling a home, you have a larger down payment. You're generally going to put 10% down, 20% down, sometimes as much as 30% down. Because you're selling a home, you're walking away with $200,000-$300,000 in equity. It's a lot better because the risk is going to be much smaller because you got more into the game. You're not putting $10,000 into a home and that's all you've got into the deal. Now you've got $200,000 into the deal. So underwriting is going to be a little more liberal and a little more forgiving because you've got so much into the game. You've got your, you know, you've got a lot more to lose. You're going to figure out how to make it work. So I would say the other thing is now you've got more stability in work. That maybe they've worked at that job for 2 years or 3 years or 4 years, the same job. The other thing is they've also got their credit established. They've had credit for longer. That move-up buyer has, you know, been able to pay off some debt, and he's been able to establish a pattern of making payments. So he may have started out with a 680 credit score. Now the second time home buyer has an 800 credit score, an 820 credit score. They've got a better credit history, better job history, better down payment. It's a lot less risk to anybody.
I listened to Dave Ramsey for many years.
Yes. I like some things he says.
And yeah, and he's like, don't borrow money for anything other than maybe a house. I won't beat you up on that. Is he a hero in the mortgage world, or do people like, no, don't listen to Dave Ramsey because you'll never have wealth because tell me what.
Dave Ramsey has a lot of good stuff. A lot of stuff he does say is good. Stay out of debt. Yes. I personally think three lines of credit is okay. A mortgage, a car payment, and a Visa card. You really don't need more than that. People that have 15 credit cards, that's bad. They're living off credit cards. And they're like, oh, but they're zero interest. Oh, but they're, you know, 6 months free, whatever. The accumulation of credit cards is the detrimental to you. You're going to end up in debt. You're going to end up in a crisis. And you're going to have to borrow money to do a debt consolidation. There's going to be several things that's going to hurt your credit score. Your interest rates are going to be higher because now you've got such low credit score, you're going to pay higher interest rate. So it's a snowballing effect. Yes, maybe a small mortgage payment, a small car payment, and a Visa that you're paying off, you know, try to pay off every month. Yes. I personally think it's best to pay your Visa off twice a month, just because every time you get paid, if you get paid twice a month, then make a Visa payment, because utilization of that credit card, if you keep it below 30%, is going to keep you at a higher credit score.
Okay, so is having, like, does the credit limit on your cards matter?
Oh, yeah. If you have a $10,000 credit limit, then you better make sure that you keep that credit card under $5,000.
Because they look, the underwriter would look at that as as a risk. He could go out and run that sucker up.
You never want to have a $20,000 or $30,000 line of credit on a credit card unless it's for some type of business that requires that. But generally speaking, those type of credit cards aren't in your name. They're going to be in a business name. If you happen to use that much credit, it's better to have low credit card usage, but some credit card usage. Don't have no credit card usage, because no credit is bad credit. So you have to have a little bit of credit card usage, whether that be on a car loan, a Visa, and a mortgage if that's possible. But you don't need 15 credit cards. You don't need the Macy's credit card, the JCPenney credit card, the Home Depot credit card. Those are just excess, and they're carrying high rates of interest. You know, usually north of 20% interest on those. You'd much rather have your, you know, your utilization of credit on one credit card that you're paying off, you know, hopefully monthly.
What about home equity?
Home equity lines of credit can be dangerous because people have that huge line of credit, and let's say they have a $50,000 line of credit, that can be dangerous. And they carry a higher interest rate. They're usually variable. People say, you know, they use them to finish their basement, or they use it to do landscaping, or they do a debt consolidation. So there are purposes of those home equity line of credits, but if you can combine them into your first and second mortgage, that's a better solution because you're going to pay a lot less interest on that, both in rate and in interest payments. You know, a lot of people will say, hey, I've been paying on my home equity line of credit for 3 years now, and I haven't even dented it. It's still sitting at $27,000, and I haven't dented it because all they're doing is making the interest payments on them.
I just did a home equity because I am mm-hmm. doing my basement mm-hmm. into an apartment. Mm-hmm. At this stage, rolling that into my mortgage? Is that something that can be done?
It can be, yeah, absolutely. You can refinance that house, and you can pull all that equity into the first mortgage. The drawback is if you're sitting on a 2 or 3% interest rate, and now you're going to roll it into a 5 or 5.5% interest rate, then obviously you have to say, okay, if I'm paying 8.5% or 9% or 10% on my home equity line of credit, but I'm paying, you know, 4 or 5% on my first mortgage, well, then that probably makes sense. I'm only going up 0.5%. But if you're sitting at 2% interest rate, maybe rolling in that second mortgage is not going to make sense because even though it might be sitting at 8 or 10% interest rate, getting rid of that 2% mortgage may not be the best thing. You'll have to run those numbers and say, okay, does it make sense for me? Some people it makes sense because they're also rolling in the car and they're rolling in, you know, 5 credit cards and the student loans and consolidating all that debt under their mortgage sometimes makes sense because now you're saving them $1,500 or $2,000 a month in payments. That definitely makes sense. They're getting rid of 20% credit cards and 15%, you know, home equity line of credit. That definitely makes sense because they're getting rid of all that debt and they're getting rid of those high interest rate credit cards or car payments. And now you're saving them $2,000 a month in monthly payments. Now they can breathe. So even though they gave up that 3% interest rate, but they can breathe now.
It changes the shape of the debt, but they can manage it better now.
Yes.
Okay.
That's more important to a lot of people because they're drowning, and so they don't care that they lost their 2% interest rate. Yeah, they care, but now they're saving $2,000 a month outgo. That makes more sense to them.
What else have I not asked you about this world, the mortgage world, that you want to share as we come to a close here?
Well, I think let's talk a little bit about what the Federal Reserve has been doing. Obviously, everybody knows that Federal Reserve has raised interest rates quite a bit over the last year or so because they've been trying to fight inflation. We're seeing a lot of inflation in the market. You're paying more for food. You're paying more for your car insurance. You're paying more for lots of items. And the Federal Reserve can't control everything with monetary policy or fiscal policy because there obviously is things that are out of control. If cars are costing more money and they're costing more to insure, and with all the electronics and all the gadgets in a car nowadays, they cost a lot more to repair. They cost a lot more to buy. So insurance is going up. With a lot of the natural disasters, whether it be fires or floods or hail damage or those houses are costing a lot more to replace with home prices being where they're at. And you're obviously going to have your home insurance go up. You're seeing your escrow account. You're seeing the taxes go up. You're seeing home insurance go up. You're seeing things that cost more money. Federal Reserve can control a little bit that through by raising rates and slowing down the economy. But it's not a cure-all. They're never going to be able to solve all the problems of things costing more money. And that's just that's just the nature of the beast. Things are high tech now, and that high tech costs money. You notice every car now has a big flat screen TV in it, to control that car, whether it be a Tesla or a Rivian or an Oldsmobile. They all have flat screens in them, and those just cost more money. And so the insurance companies charge you more money to repair those cars because they get in accidents, and not like your 1990 car didn't have any electronics in it. So it's just costs more money. They're better cars, and they cost more money, and the insurance costs more money. Everything costs more money. So Federal Reserve has been really slow to react. They should have probably raised rates and, you know, sooner than they did, and maybe combated some of that inflationary pressure. They were slow to do it. Now they're slow to bring rates back down again. They don't seem to be in a hurry. They seem to be very lackadaisive. And so the Federal Reserve has done some things to curb inflation, but they've been really slow to move rates back down again and to help our economy. I feel like sometimes we're in a little bit of a recession and they're not realizing that, they're not reacting soon enough. So that hurts us because people are still waiting for the rates to come down to 5% to purchase a home. But, you know, we've heard that, hey, just buy the house, refinance later. And I still believe that. I think you're losing out on appreciation on the market, because if you buy that $550,000 house and you wait 2 years, now you're going to wish that you bought it, because now that house now is worth $600,000 and you just missed out on $50,000 of appreciation in that 2 year period.
Yeah. How can people stay, if they're not in the financial world? I mean, you and I work in this industry, but where can people go to stay on top of what's happening besides the news? Because the news is going to piss people. They're going to try to divide and piss people off, because that's what they do. That's how they make their money, and I get it. Where can people educate themselves?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I spend a lot of time trying to cut through the noise and getting the real facts. I spend a lot of money actually on services that provide us where the bond market's going and where the interest rates are going and job reports and inflation reports. And I'm a little bit of a nerd that way, because I look a lot of economic data to try to forecast where rates are going and what the world's going at. But me being a little bit of a nerd that way, because I actually have a degree in economics and a master's in business. And so I'm a little bit nerdy when it comes to watching, you know, whatever the inflationary pressures are, or maybe the job market, you know, unemployment, or, looking at just even, you know, what the stock market's doing, because that has an impact in us. Or, you know, if we have, you know, even wars can impact, you know, interest rates. Lots of things can impact interest rates. Or even home prices. We saw when there was a lumber shortage, or when there was shortages even to get certain things from China. And we're seeing that right now. We're seeing cargo ships being stopped in the Red Sea, and pirates are taking over these cargo ships. And so we're seeing, you know, delays in shipping, or we're seeing cost of shipping be more expensive. Getting things even through the canal right now, the Panama Canal. They used to have about 40 or 45 ships go through the canal, but right now the capacity is down to 20 because they don't have enough water to fill the docks. And so we're seeing a lot of pressures just come from, shipping containers being able to get here. Because, you know, there's a lot of mirrors and toilets and lots of supplies inside of a house that are coming from China. A lot of building materials come from China still. And or other countries, and that causes home prices to shoot up if they can't get those supplies. You know, so back to the supply and demand. When there's a demand, sometimes people will pay a lot of money. We saw that with toilet paper. You know, people were going down to Costco and they were paying a lot of money for toilet paper during the COVID years.
All right, I have to stop you there. That still boggles my mind. Why, if the world's coming to an end, like people thought it was, why is toilet paper? It was toilet paper and what else during that time?
It was crazy.
Toilet paper. Yeah. Who thinks if it's an emergency, I need to make sure I can wipe my butt without using my hands?
That's just crazy. Complete craziness.
That was a fluky marketing thing.
Yes.
Because that is not essential.
No, it's not. People can still use.
You can still poop. Newspaper. Yeah, or whatever.
Yeah, well, newspapers are hard to get these days, but they use newspapers. And but yes, sometimes things are, you know, sometimes there's supply and demand on weird things that makes no sense at all.
And with social media, someone could say, "Oh, I saw it's a run on mittens. Go get your mittens."
Well, we saw social media do the same thing with GameStop. They ran that stock from $3 to $300 a share. You know, there was no rhyme or reason to do that, other than they were trying to stick it to the people that shorted this stock, and they were trying to stick it to Wall Street. But yes, we saw GameStop run up from $3 to $300 a share, not because the company was great and was prosperous, but just because there was a social media presence that caused that stock to run up.
That's fascinating.
So yes, social media can cause things to not be normal.
Which is now our new normal,
yes.
Not being normal.
Well, we saw this in 98, 99, and we saw the tech bubble. I was looking at those financials of all these tech companies, and yes, they're all driving Lamborghinis and Ferraris, but they were bleeding red, and it made no sense for these stocks to climb like they were climbing. And sure enough, the tech bubble did crash and burn, and those companies went out of business, but they had no business of running their stock up, and there was no business of those owners and executives to buying Ferraris and Lamborghinis because their company was losing money hands over fist. So, but it was all, you know, it was all hype to get into the tech business.
Well, my crystal ball's broken. Yours is a little more clear than mine, but yeah, it's.
But I truly believe that home prices will continue to rise. They're not going to rise at 6, 10%, no, but they'll rise at modest 1 or 2%, which is healthy. Yes, interest rates will come down. I truly believe we'll see in 2024, we'll see, you know, interest rates in the 5, maybe 5.5%, but that'll be good. Those are good mediums. 2% is too low in the interest rates, 3% is too low. 5 and 6, those are healthy numbers. Appreciation of 2 or 3% appreciation in the housing market. Those are healthy. Those are healthy numbers.
A little more consistency, yes. Versus the extremes.
Yes, 100%. Yeah. So when things get crazy, that's when I walk out. I get out of that market because it's kind of crazy.
And people do things on emotion versus the data, I guess. Well, I don't have any more questions.
I don't either.
Do you have any more thoughts?
I have no thoughts.
Oh, well.
I rambled on for way longer than I probably
should
have.
You didn't ramble. That's why I had you here. How can people get in touch with you if they needed to, if they wanted to?
TroyWarner.com.
TroyWarner.com.
Yes.
Dang. That's easy enough.
That's the easiest.
Perfect. Well, thank you, sir, for coming by.
No, I enjoyed talking to you, and it's always good to put some stuff out there that is real, and I feel like it's not to benefit anybody but the end user.
Well, that's what we want. Bring some value to people. All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you again for listening to the Parish the Thought Show. We know you have many podcast options and appreciate that you have chosen us. If you love what you hear, please give us a rating on whatever platform you find us. And don't forget to share, like, and subscribe. If you hate what you hear, only tell us. You're still here? Click on the next episode for more from The Parish the Thought Show.